In 2006, Thomas Homer Dixon, author of The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization, wrote, "September 11th in Katrina won't be the last time we walk out of our cities. Whether from economic collapse, terrorism, climate change, pandemic, energy scarcity, or the widening gap between rich and poor," he wrote, this again was in 2006, "that breakdown was inevitable. And if we won't change our ways till we crash, it's up to us to make sure that breakdown doesn't spiral into total collapse." Check out the book title. Today, down seems to be everywhere. Okay, that's the catastrophe part, but I'm going to talk with Homer Dixon in search of the creativity and the renewal. In the book, he compared our situation to driving too fast along a country road in a dense fog. The car's headlights are like the best experts in forecasting technologies. They can tell you something, but they can't make out anything with absolute certainty. And yet, he wrote, then many people act as if they have a pretty good idea where we're going. They ignore the fog. They keep their foot pressed on the accelerator. But let's face it, most of us have felt like fairly helpless passengers on this wild ride. Well, in the year and a half since that book and our last interview, crises, especially the global financial and economic meltdown, have escalated dramatically. Is this a deadly crash that we're rushing toward? Is this the crisis it will take for us to change what we're doing? Is there a positive path through the rough road ahead? Thomas Homer Dixon holds the Center for International Governance Innovation Chair of Global Systems at the Basili School of International Affairs in Waterloo, Canada. He's a professor in the Center for Environment and Business in the faculty at that university. In his previous book, The Ingenuity Gap, won the Governor General's Literary Award for Nonfiction in Canada. Welcome again, Thomas Homer Dixon.
That's marvelous to be with you again, Terry.
Great. Thanks a lot, Thomas. As you may know, I like listeners to get a bit of a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So, you're a Canadian. How do you think that has influenced your thinking?
Well, there's a sweeping question. I think, you know, one's individual personality and temperament always tends to outweigh the importance of cultural background in terms of determining one's perspective on the world. But I think there are a few things in Canadian culture that probably have fundamentally shaped the way I see things.
And I've asked that question partly because I think in some ways, and this is just, you know, my perspective from where I sit, that Canada is in sort of a funny, unique position, being so adjacent to the U.S., having so much of an overlap with the U.S., and yet being very much different than the U.S.
Well, we're kind of an interesting amalgam of European and American culture, and they're very distinct threads of each in our society. I think one of the, to be somewhat simplistic about it, but one of the determining characteristics of Canada has been that it's a harsh climate and it's a harsh geography that our society has been established in. And one of the ways that we've learned to survive is to pull together. We're a less individualistic and more communitarian society. We tend to see more readily the value of government and the state in solving problems that we can't solve easily by ourselves. So something like universal health care is just an accepted institutional feature of our societies, and it's amazing how much support it has from every walk of life and every class, socioeconomic level in the society, because we see that as something that we have to do together as a community of people, individuals who care about each other and have to work together to make something good happen. And I think at least in the last few decades, the individualistic sentiment has really dominated in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to a certain extent we've seen some of the consequences of that in this economic crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting what you say. I know that L.A. faces it only maybe when there's a big fire, or even that isn't quite it, but when there was an earthquake, or when there's we do have enough rain that occasionally there's floods, that sense of a common enemy or a common threat pulls people together. And I guess what you're saying is in a country in as harsh a climate as Canada, that happens on a much more regular basis.
It's a rather permanent and deep feature of our culture, and informs people's actions and our institutions in ways that's almost unseen but still very powerful. I notice that President Obama is appealing to the same sentiment, much as FDR did in the 1930s. You know, that we have to pull together, we have to sacrifice individually for the collective good. I mean, it's even part of the argument supporting the demand that that bonuses be returned, AIG bonuses be returned to the American taxpayer. Everybody has to play their bit now because we're in this together. And that's something that does come to the surface. There's in the United States, there's always that pendulum swing between a communitarian and a more individualistic sentiment in the dominant culture, but the individualistic has really prevailed, I think, over the last several decades.
Oh yeah, yeah. Will Hutton from the UK wrote a wonderful book about the Declaration of Interdependence, in which he really pointed out how the U.S. had diverged from the beginnings, but specifically over the last 30 years, from much of the rest of the world, and then was, you know, doing its best to drag much of the rest of the world with it in that individualistic pursuit, and has dragged much of the rest of the world into its economic crisis. Thomas Homer Dixon, in late 2006, you said, I'm gonna read now here, we can say the probability of some major problems developing in the future is probably rising. So the issue then is, what are we going to do on those occasions? How are we going to respond in times of crisis?
Yes.
Are we now, you had talked about energy and climate and those sorts of things and pandemics and so on, but are we now in one of those times of crisis, and how are we responding?
Yes, we are, and I don't think we can answer the second question yet. I don't think the story's fully told. I had a long section in that last book, The Upside of Down, on the global economy and the potential for exactly the kind of crisis that we're experiencing now. In fact, you know, a number of people have noted that the kind of cascading systemic failures that I talked about and predicted are seem to be coming to pass. In fact, I've been talking about exactly this kind of failure now for almost 15 years, going back to my original book that you mentioned, the Ingenuity Gap. And it's caused by a lot of different factors. One that is perhaps powerful, but not, you know, the exclusive cause, is the very tight connectivity in our world that contributes to cascading failures in systems, so that you have a shock in one part of a tightly coupled system, and it produces failures and problems all across the system very rapidly. And what we've managed to do in just about every system humankind has created, whether it's economic or technological, our information systems, our international transportation systems, our food systems, is that they're all tightly coupled. And so they're all vulnerable to this kind of row of dominoes falling over like failure. And that, you know, there are lots of people who've said that at a certain point, increased connectivity in our world is actually a detriment. That it actually undermines our well-being. But I think the prevailing sentiment over the last couple of decades, especially promoted by proponents of globalization, has been that the more connectivity, the better. You know, we just connect everything to, you know, as much as possible together and move material and energy and information faster and faster, and we'll all be better off.
This idea of connectivity, globalization, good for all, in a way that has a hint, or it implies that we are in this together, and I think maybe one of the things that happens is when you have the push to the connectivity, at the same time as it's being, say, run by those who haven't necessarily signed the social contract, but are looking at their huge bonuses and their individual you know, benefits that are so unequal with others, that is part of what creates the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you've got this exactly right. It's a kind of a paradox, really, that the increased connectivity produces a situation of shared fate, where we're all in it together. And yet we've had a culture that, as you said, the United States has tried to propagate around the world through an American version of capitalism, of extreme individualism, where people think they don't have to be concerned about the common weal and the public good because the market will solve that problem. The hidden hand of the market will always produce the best social outcome and the best economic outcome. Well, we can see that that's just not the case. Capitalism is an enormously powerful and productive institution and economic system. Markets are wonderful problem-solving arrangements, but they exist and function properly within an architecture of regulation and rules, from property rights to banking systems. And that takes a lot of thought. It takes a lot of ingenuity and creativity to make it work properly. And, the World Bank realized this quite some time ago, during the 1990s. During the 1980s, with the Reaganite revolution, there was this perception that the way you got countries to develop is just to get government out of the way. But in the mid-1990s, the World Bank came out with a very important report saying, the countries that are doing best are those with competent, strong states that can manage markets effectively. So, again, we've had a lot of the connectivity, but none of the responsibility that comes with the connectivity.
Right.
I'd like to see more responsibility and a little bit less connectivity, and I think we would be in much better shape if that were true.
Yeah. One of the things I've been noting over the last, few months, both in terms of outside the studio, but often with the guests that I've been talking to here, is something similar to what you just said, is that, or at least what I read into what you said, it was that can this crisis lead us to temper and adapt what we've been doing? William Grider, who's been a powerful critic for years of the Federal Reserve, of the military-industrial complex, etc., his next book is called Come Home, America, hoping that this crisis or this confluence of a number of crises will lead to something new. And I see that among other folks as well. You said at the top that you think it's too early to assess how we are responding to this financial meltdown. Do you see some of what I've just been talking about?
I see some of it. I have a lot of respect for Grider's work, and I've used it in the past. I think he's a very smart person. But if Come Home America simply means let's turn inwards and deal with our own problems, I think that's as mistaken.
No, I don't think it's that. I think it's come home to our original principles.
Well, and that's right, and which were, in many respects, communitarian principles.
Right.
And
the whole idea of federating these different states with different
exactly.
cultures and so on, and basing a government on an idea, that's
right.
pretty communitarian.
It was, and it was republicanism in contrast to the authoritarianism of the British Crown,
mm-hmm.
and it was understood as the need for the colonies to pull together and the citizens to pull together to make it work. Extraordinarily powerful, noble ideas that have influenced the course of history around the world. If that's what he means, and that is good. The larger issue, though, is, and it's the one that I emphasize in my last book, and it's why it has the title "The Upside Down," is can crisis be galvanic? Can it catalyze us to see the world in new ways, to break through vested interests and special interests, to change in profound ways our institutions and our behaviors, or is it just a license for extremism? And I actually think that societies in times of crisis can go in one direction or the other.
Absolutely. I know that when we spoke in 2006, we talked about that FDR and Hitler both seized on the crises of the Great Depression.
Exactly. And I think we're at a similar moment of contingency right now. And we're now seeing some 50% of societies in the world, of countries in the world, experiencing political instability as a result of this economic crisis.
Wow.
Now, I happen to believe that this economic crisis is nowhere near its end. I mean, I have every desire, my whole soul wants Obama to pull us out of this nosedive. I mean, we all our finances, our personal household finances, are being directly affected by this economic crisis. So we all have a very strong interest in hoping that he succeeds. And yet there's something inside me that says that really what Obama and his elite economic decision makers are proposing is fundamentally more of the same. It's not a fundamentally reformed system. It's an adjusted system. It's a tweaked system.
Well, let me read something that describes, I think, you know, some of what you talk about in the book, a management approach, which is characterized by, I'm reading here, generally incremental policy adjustments, often involving modular addition of technologies and institutions to older systems that are left unchanged, and that this leads to greater complexity of institutions and technologies in response to increasingly complex problems, and reluctance to challenge powerful economic and political interests that benefit from the status quo. When I read that in preparation for the show, I thought exactly, you know, kind of what you were just saying, that describes what they're doing when both the crisis and the opportunity, it seems to me, ask for something more.
I think that's the case so far. But it's interesting that President Obama has showed that he has political tools at his disposal that allow him to start circumventing some of those vested interests and special interests. So when he's run into a crisis with his budget and with his financial plan over the last couple of weeks, he's simply bypassed the mainstream media, and he's gone on Jay Leno and 60 Minutes and spoken directly to the American people in a way that I think has turned out to be really quite powerful. He has mobilized his internet constituency, and that's a different kind of politics. But whether he's really using those political tools to provide the kind of deep reform, I don't think is clear yet. And I hate to say it, because now my personal household interests, my family interests, are at variance with my intellectual instincts. But I think the crisis has not yet been severe enough to produce the kind of deep change, the call for really deep change. And it's all tangled up with other issues that Obama also considers to be very important, including healthcare, including climate and energy issues. And one of the reasons we've got climate and energy problems that are extremely serious in this world is that we have economies around the world that are addicted to growth, addicted to steadily increasing throughput of energy and materials.
Well, I mean, let's be, you know, that is the model of all the, it seems to me, the top of capitalism.
That's right.
Is that addiction to growth.
And we sustained that growth through an increasingly precarious edifice of credit, sustained by increasingly ludicrous financial innovation and complex financial innovation. And we've had to maintain that growth because it's allowed us to pay our accumulated debts, or at least punt the debts into the future. We believe that it maintains our freedom. And most fundamentally, we believe, and I think there's some truth to this belief, that growth maintains social peace because it's a lubricant between rich and poor classes. Now, until we can deal with those problems of solvency, freedom, and peace without perpetual growth of our economies, we're not really dealing with fundamental issues. And I don't see that kind of discussion happening yet.
What you were just saying there, I thought it was interesting. Until we deal with solvency, freedom, and peace in some other way than through an addiction to growth. Is that basically what you were saying?
That's right. Now, we haven't really figured out what that other way might be. And there are people like Herman Daly, a radical economist who was for a while based at the World Bank at the University of Maryland, a very thoughtful man, have done a lot of work on what he would call a steady-state economy, an economy that provides goods and services people need without growing. But that is a largely economic analysis. It's a technical economic analysis. Less work has been done on the sociological, ethical, moral, political implications of a no-growth society. And I just think it's an urgent task. Towards the end of The Upside of Down, you may remember I say, this is one of the biggest intellectual challenges we've got. And I haven't seen, in the 2 years since the book was published, I've seen very little further conversation about the matter. And yet, the crisis we're facing right now is in large part attributable to our addiction to growth,
mm-hmm.
and the necessity recognized by economic elites of maintaining liquidity at all costs within our world economy in order to maintain growth and maintain consumption.
Well, you know, but aren't they, I mean, isn't more endangered by a lack of liquidity than just growth and consumption, or not?
Well, those three equations I was talking about,
yeah,
sort of point to the three key things. If we don't grow, we can't grow out of our debts. We tend to grow out of our debts at the household level and at the societal level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we pay off our pension obligations, we pay off our national debt, we pay off our household debts, our mortgages, by increasing our income over time and our wealth. There's this notion, well developed in a book which is titled something like The Moral Argument for Economic Growth by Benjamin Friedman at Harvard University. He's an economist at Harvard, a couple years ago, that economic growth is fundamentally associated with personal liberty. And in a static, steady-state economy, you can't really have the kind of freedom that we've come to love and enjoy.
Not enough mobility if things stay the same?
Yeah, and you get a kind of ossification, institutional rigidification of societies, and I think there's a lot to be said for that.
Now, let me jump right in, because the thing that occurs to me is when I've certainly read and talked to Daly, the folks at Redefining Progress, et cetera, and the notion that growth doesn't have to be growth in quantity, but that can be growth in quality, should somehow be able to help in some of that,
yes,
bringing people along without wasting more energy, more resources, more waste, etc.
Yeah, I think this is a really fundamental issue. People are trying to square the circle in some ways by saying, okay, well, we just have to redefine growth or redefine progress. We have to change our values so that we can have the growth, but it's a non-material growth. It's a growth in, you know, I sometimes facetiously call it things like poets on street corners. If we decide we like poets on street corners, and that they're very important to us, we can have lots of poets on street corners without increasing the material throughput of our societies, except to the extent we have to feed them and house them. You know, they're not very materially intensive. And we can include a line item in our GDP calculations that could be very substantial for the value we place on poets on street corners. And you can imagine, you know, bidding wars and all kinds of things to have the best poet on your street corner. Now, that's a values issue. We just actually don't value poets on street corners very much, so they don't really turn up as a line item in our GDP calculations, as opposed to, say, you know, five-bedroom houses with three-car garages and annual trips to some exotic tropical location. Now, to a certain extent, I think value change can help us here, but I don't think it's actually going to get us the whole way. There is some fundamental material component any notion of growth, whether it's a notion of growth that emphasizes spiritual improvement, or a notion of growth that emphasizes bigger houses. The bottom line is that, just to, you know, put this in very specific terms, we've become vastly more efficient in producing goods and services, vastly more efficient in terms of the amount of material or energy we use per dollar of GDP. So in some sense, we've dematerialized our GDP a lot in the last 40 years, at the
mm-hmm.
rate of about 2% a year. But overall, our economies are materially much larger, because our economic growth has swamped all improvements in efficiency.
Right.
So, you know, we might slowly change our values, but the likelihood is that our overall economic growth will swamp any slow change in values.
And then when you add a population to that.
Yeah, and when you add population, and the end result, as we surge towards a global population of 9 billion people, is that, you know, the World Bank expects, in real terms, the global economy will expand from a current $70 trillion a year, somewhat smaller because of the economic
right.
crisis, to somewhere around $300 trillion a year by 2060 in today's dollars. Now, that's just not going to happen.
That's right.
We're already blowing the doors off the world climate. It's,
yeah.
it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And we're either going to stop that process voluntarily this century, or it will stop involuntarily, and it will probably be horrifically violent.
Right. Right. Let me. I've got to pull this to a close. But one, I don't even know if you have time to respond to this. But one of the things that has been occurring to me is the last few minutes is the difference between a farmer's market and a supermarket. Farmer's market gets you food, perhaps, hopefully, of better quality, but it also gets you an experience of better quality. And there are ripple effects of that. People have more conversations. People have more relationships. People think more about what they're buying in a farmer's market. I mean, is that, and I only have time for a yes
very
or no,
good answer.
Is this a model for where we're going, where we need to go?
Yes. It helps build social capital, those relations between people. People go to farmers markets because they value the experience, not just the food that they buy. It also helps promote regional self-sufficiency.
Exactly. More, I mean, there's a lot that you can dig, I think, out of that. So, again, I've been speaking with Thomas Homer Dixon. The book is The Upside of Down. The websites are theupsideofdown.com and homerdixon.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many other during the week by linking to our podcast. You can find information about my podcast at email me at temcnally@mac.com. temcnally@mac.com. I also have a list that I send out to every week telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, a little background of the issue. So that's something you probably want to get on. Thank you to Thomas Homer Dixon. Keep up the good work.